Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. For the next 60 minutes, you'll hear many of the news and feature stories that made up our daily VOA Asia programs. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. We start at the beginning of the week with my VOA Asia colleague, Jim Stevenson.
President Donald Trump has announced a decision to send ventilators to India, adding that both countries are cooperating on developing a vaccine for the virus.
We're sending a lot of ventilators to India. I spoke to Prime Minister Modi, and we're sending quite a few ventilators to India. We have a tremendous supply of ventilators.
Prime Minister Narendra Modi on Saturday thanked the United States for the pledge, underlining the importance of nations working together during the coronavirus pandemic. The White House did not specify the number of ventilators that would be sent to India. The U.S. has promised to send ventilators to several countries hit by the virus that has claimed more than 307,000 lives worldwide and infected more than 4.5 million people. President Trump also acknowledged the great Indian-American scientists and researchers who were contributing to the development of a coronavirus vaccine. Last month, India had allowed export of hydroxychloroquine after Trump urged New Delhi to release supplies of the drug seen as a possible treatment for COVID-19 in the United States, where more than 87,500 deaths have been attributed to the virus, with over 1.4 million infected, according to Johns Hopkins University data. President Trump, meanwhile, unveiled Operation Warp Speed, an initiative aimed at developing a coronavirus vaccine by the end of the year, although he vowed the country would reopen with or without one. The Trump administration also laid out plans to expand an initiative to ensure the United States does not run out of critical medical supplies. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara reports.
U.S. President Donald Trump intends to have hundreds of millions of coronavirus vaccine doses available by January 2021.
It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast.
Most public health experts agree it's an ambitious timeline, but they say it may be possible to have a vaccine ready for emergency use on high-risk groups, such as healthcare workers and the elderly.
Everything would have to go perfectly. I think for the general population, we are really still looking at an 18-month endeavor here if all goes well.
With an election looming in November, Trump is also keeping his eye on reopening the country and its economy.
Vaccine or no vaccine, we're back. And we're starting the process. And in many cases, they don't have vaccines. And a virus or a flu comes, and you fight through it.
Trump has expressed support for protesters who want individual states to lift stay-at-home orders and open their economies, though many do not meet his own administration's criteria to do so. Some include so-called red states that voted for Trump in 2016. Analysts say Trump's support for protesters may hurt him politically if states that reopen too early see a rise in the number of coronavirus cases.
It is a big risk to take, and what we're seeing now with cases emerging in rural areas and in places where Trump has been strongest, the red states and the red parts of blue states, suggests that this could be a gambit that could backfire.
God bless the USA. Earlier this week, Trump also announced plans to ensure the nation has enough supply of medical and emergency gear.
Instead of 1 to 3 weeks worth of supplies, we had less than that. The U.S. government will now stockpile 3 whole months, much of it made in the USA.
The Trump administration has been criticized by some for the country's lack of personal protective equipment in the early weeks of the pandemic. Replenishing the strategic national stockpile is seen as critical.
It's really important that we do everything we can now to prepare for a fall or winter pandemic wave when we will likely have both flu as well as COVID-19 at the same time.
The administration plans to expand American manufacturing of these medical supplies to reduce reliance on foreign companies and create jobs domestically. Patsy Whitaker-Swara, VOA News, Washington.
China is touting its success in curbing the outbreak of COVID-19 that has now spread to the rest of the world. But the so-called success came at a steep price. The state's massive surveillance network now intrudes even further into people's lives, with more crackdowns on speech and more government critics in prison. Beijing argues the hardline measures are necessary, but other countries show they may not be necessary. We hear more in this report written by VOA State Department correspondent Nike Ching.
Around the world, many popular landmarks and streets remain empty due to restrictions amid the COVID-19 outbreak. Yet in some places, schools, offices, and restaurants are gradually reopening, including in China, once the world's coronavirus epicenter. U.S. President Donald Trump initially praised Beijing's response to the outbreak, but as the virus spread and more Americans died, Washington accused China of hiding key information about the origins of the coronavirus. China rejects the criticism and points to its support of the World Health Organization in fighting the pandemic. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says this assertion ignores how Beijing continues to undermine the global effort.
We still don't have the samples that we need. We still don't have the access. We collectively, the world, don't have the samples. It's not even just that in the moment they couldn't do the right thing. They continue to be opaque. They continue to deny access for this important information that our research, our epidemiologists need. And importantly, this could happen again.
Beijing insists it is cooperating and being transparent, even though it has not allowed international scientists access to the Wuhan virology lab and other places that may have played a role in igniting the pandemic.
For some time, the U.S. government has ignored the facts, diverted public attention, and passed the buck in an attempt to shirk its responsibility for incompetence in the fight against the epidemic. This approach will not erase Chinese people's achievements in the epidemic prevention and control through hard work.
China positions itself as the leader to fight the pandemic, but the achievements to control the coronavirus are not Beijing's alone. Some senior U.S. officials say democratic governments like Taiwan are examples of how authorities can effectively respond without undermining individual rights. Retired Brigadier General Robert Spalding from the Hudson Institute spoke to VOA via Skype.
You know, when you look at the way that they've taken care of their population by providing information and transparency and also acting quickly as a government to implement the kind of controls and protections, Taiwan's actually fared through the virus very well, and they've really given, I think, the world a model.
Taiwan uses air and sea border controls, quickly identifies new cases, notifies others with real-time alerts, and has used funds and military personnel to increase mask production. For its part, China has provided millions of test kits and protective gear for countries battling the virus, diplomatic outreach that some say has been helpful, despite some complaints over faulty equipment. And as vaccine development gets underway, the country expects to be a part of the solution, says Chinese entrepreneur and philanthropist Jack Ma.
In my opinion, the epidemic will not end within a short time, and it can only vanish by relying on technological breakthroughs, innovation, and medical research. So we have to make long-term preparation.
But others say Beijing's aid has not made up for its failures. Bonnie Glazer from CSIS spoke to VOA via Skype.
I think the countries have not forgotten the mishandling by China of the outbreak of the crisis. It's cover-up of doctors within China. It's domination of the World Health Organization. It's failure to share completely transparent information with the rest of the world. So over the longer run, I actually think it's going to have a negative impact on China's reputation.
Now China and other countries are battling a new wave of coronavirus infections, putting their pandemic response systems and their political systems to another test. For Nike Ching, I'm Elizabeth Cherneff for VOA News.
In Michigan last week, protesters gathered at the state capitol to express their frustration with the state's lockdown rules. Such protests have sprouted up around the United States as some people are bucking against what they see as overreaching government control in their lives. Matt Dibble reports.
Open up! Open up! Rain didn't stop protesters from showing up at the state capitol in Lansing, Michigan, Thursday to express their frustrations with the state's lockdown orders.
We have a right to make a living.
Remember,
where did that go? Yeah, like they can't just tell us we can't go to work anymore. That's our right. That's our right to make a living.
To support the complete opening of Michigan.
Yep.
That's why we're here. This is not a dictatorship.
It's just tyranny that the government's doing. There's just no excuse for it. They're trying to equate this thing with the bubonic plague or tuberculosis. It's a problem, to be sure, but the cure is worse than the disease.
Protests like these are popping up here and there in cities and towns across the United States. They are part of an effort to push governments to open the economy. But they also bring together a mix of causes: gun rights, anti-vaccination, anti-government but pro-Trump administration, who have seized the moment to further their agendas.
I think the government's role should be assisting, not controlling. So what we've clearly seen is the government taking a very controlling stance.
This is a total power grab. This is the biggest wealth transfer this world has ever seen.
And half these deaths aren't even real. I mean, I get people are dying, but half these deaths are not even real.
Many cast the government restrictions as a curtailment on their liberty and express their mistrust with information they hear about the virus. These messages have been amplified by well-funded right-wing groups who are supporting the protesters in various ways, says Lisa Graves, who studies political movements.
One is by providing them, basically urging them to do the protests and providing them guidance on optics, on how to make the protests look for the press, for press coverage. Another thing that we're seeing is the creation of social media sites or websites to help organize the people to advance these protests, to make them into a sort of a longer-term political operation to advance their agenda. They have really been something that people can't stop watching because it's just so shocking to many people to see people coming out armed to their state capitals. They've gotten, I think, in some ways, a disproportionate amount of coverage based on the fact that most Americans, the overwhelming majority of Americans, believe we need to have these measures in place to protect our lives and the lives of people we love.
Counter-protesters have also attended the events, most notably healthcare workers wearing face masks. John Rose felt compelled to attend Thursday's rally because he was upset about seeing guns in the Capitol.
I am not against gun rights, but there's no reason for it.
For some people, though, protesting is simply a way of being heard, standing up for the economic pain felt by many.
I am here particularly for the small business owners that are struggling right now and for the people that are forced to be unemployed and struggling to feed their families right now.
There are signs that the protests are having some effect. This week, the Wisconsin Supreme Court threw out that state's stay-at-home order, siding with Republican lawmakers in a dispute with the Democratic governor. For VOA News, Matt Dibble.
We continue with VOA Asia Weekend. This reminder for you, make certain you stay up to date in our ever-changing world. Check in at any time to voanews.com along with our many social media offerings. China announces it's giving a lot of money to the World Health Organization. The story from AP's Sagar Mughani.
As President Trump continues blasting China and the World Health Organization over their virus response, Beijing is rallying around the WHO. Speaking through an interpreter at the World Health Assembly,
China will provide $2 billion over 2 years to help with COVID-19 response.
Chinese President Xi Jinping's pledge comes as the Trump administration has slashed the UN Health Agency's funding and tried to undermine its credibility, with the president saying it helped China conceal the pandemic's extent early on. Sagar Mughani, Washington.
The head of the World Health Organization says he will begin an independent evaluation of the UN Health Agency's response to the coronavirus pandemic at the earliest appropriate moment. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus made the pledge Monday after an independent oversight advisory body published its first interim report about the UN Health Agency's response to COVID-19 from January to April.
To be successful, we must all commit to mutual ownership and accountability. One way to do that proposed by the Africa Group last year is through a system of universal periodic review, in which countries agree to a regular and transparent review of each nation's preparedness. We urge countries to proceed with caution. Countries that move too fast without putting in place the public health architecture to detect and suppress transmission run a real risk of handicapping their own recovery. The risk remains high, and we have a long road to travel.
The 11-page report raised questions such as whether WHO's warning system for alerting the world to outbreaks was adequate, and suggested member states might need to reassess WHO's role in providing travel advice to countries. The advisory body's review and recommendations appeared unlikely to appease the United States administration, which has been scathing in its criticism of WHO, in part over President Donald Trump's allegation that it had criticized the U.S. travel ban that he ordered on people arriving from China, where the outbreak first appeared late last year. Do American workers need more financial help from the government? That is the question being argued by U.S. lawmakers as another coronavirus relief bill now goes to the Senate. Many Democrats and Republicans have very different views on what it's going to take to help the U.S. economy after it was devastated by the pandemic. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has the story.
As U.S. businesses continue to slowly reopen, how to repair the economic damage caused by the pandemic is a partisan issue. The $3 trillion coronavirus relief bill passed in the U.S. House of Representatives reflects the differences between Republicans and Democrats.
First, open the economy, test, test, test. Two, we want to honor our heroes by helping state and local entities. And three, we want to put money in the pockets of the American people.
With a presidential election just months away, the latest bill, Republicans say, is packed with Democratic priorities.
It's got so much unrelated to the coronavirus, it is dead on arrival here in terms of a viable idea. The amount of money and the way you spend the money and the unrelated provisions in the bill make it impossible for it to get out of the Senate.
The bill includes student debt forgiveness and financial assistance to frontline healthcare workers, renters and homeowners, and farmers. The legislation would also allow undocumented immigrants to get payments if they file taxes.
Nancy Pelosi basically lost me with that package when she has $1,200 checks for illegal immigrants, and it just goes downhill from there.
But Vermont Senator and former Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders says another stimulus act is critical.
There are people today who cannot afford to go to a doctor even when they have coronavirus symptoms. If you're concerned about the working class of this country, understand the extraordinary suffering, unprecedented, that is now taking place. Demand that Congress act.
Sanders says the Senate needs to improve on the current legislation to help people who aren't working during the pandemic.
I happen to believe that we should go in the direction of a paycheck security process similar to what has been done in Europe, which says to every worker in America, you will continue to receive your paycheck and the other benefits which you had when you were on the job. And when this crisis is over, hopefully sooner than later, you're just going to go back to work.
But White House trade advisor Peter Navarro says President Donald Trump has a different plan to grow the economy.
For every service sector job we might lose as we adjust to this China virus, we're going to have to replace that with manufacturing jobs, which do have a high multiplier in terms of creating service sector jobs again. So what I'm focused on with President Trump is a Buy American, Deregulate, Innovate agenda, which will start with bringing our pharma supply chains home, bringing our medical supplies and equipment supply chains home. So we build it here. That'll be both good economics, but also good national security.
With the current bill unlikely to get Senate approval, Pelosi says the Democrats are open to negotiating with the Republicans. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
In the 5 or so months since the world first began to cope with what is now the worst pandemic in living memory, health workers have continued to put their lives on the line. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with nurse Rihanna Moret a nurse who helps manage other nurses and healthcare workers in the COVID units at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, Florida.
I have been in that unit now for a little bit over a month, helping stabilize the unit, helping manage the flow of the unit, and helping manage the nurses, just making sure everybody's wearing proper PPE and being a support system for the staff and patients themselves.
So you're with the patients too?
I'm not their primary nurse, but I do have to go into the room many times when they have questions or concerns. The truth is, the patients that are here are very scared. You're alone. They don't know what's going on. They see these astronaut-looking people going into their rooms day in and day out, and just to have them be able to connect helps them a lot.
Has it been hard for you personally to adjust to working constantly on a COVID ward?
At the beginning, I was terrified. But the fact that Jackson has given us what we need in order to feel safe has helped a lot. We always have what we need to work together and protect everybody, both the patient and the nurses. If healthcare workers do not protect themselves, we can be carriers and we can be the ones spreading this even more than what is being spread already.
Do you have enough nursing staff?
So I've been very blessed to have nurses who want to come back and work in these units because of how safe they feel. They'd rather work in a COVID unit knowing what to expect than work in a regular floor where they don't know who has COVID.
You can have great protection, but there is still so much that is unknown about COVID-19.
It's exactly what you just said. You do not know who really has COVID or not until they are swabbed and come back positive.
How have you managed to cope with all this uncertainty and trauma?
At the beginning, it was very hard for me. In the first few weeks from being in a COVID unit, I found myself just wanting to lay in bed all day. I was seeing what nurses were going through. I was seeing what patients were going through. I was seeing the hard truth of what this virus does. Nursing takes a toll on you physically, mentally, on a regular day. And now you throw in a virus that we don't know about. It's just an added stress to you. So I had to find a way to cope with it. I had to find a way to know that giving all that I can is making a difference. I would love to get back to my normal life, but until then, I am here. I'm here to fight this war, and I am proud to be part of a healthcare system that truly shows that they care about their nurses and always make sure that they feel safe in this crazy world that we're living right now.
Do you think that the public is actually grateful for everything you guys are doing?
The support that we are receiving from the community is amazing. On a daily basis, I receive multiple messages through Facebook or Instagram from people who don't even know me, just reaching out and saying, hey, thank you for helping. You know, like when a lot of us are afraid and at home, you guys are out there and you're doing everything you can for these patients.
What's your personal situation?
I have two boys. They are currently with my parents who have been taking care of them for the past month and a half. It's been very hard for them, especially for the little one. He doesn't understand why he can't come around mom or why I can't hug him or why I can't give him a kiss. So I'm very lonely right now.
What is the outlook, in your opinion, going forward?
We're projecting hopefully by June to see a drop in numbers. But that all depends on the public and how they react to the opening of certain areas in the city.
Here in New York, and I think it's also true in Miami, people are going out without masks on. That must feel almost like a personal affront.
It really is. When I'm on my way to work, I'm just astonished. I see what I'm going through and what my nurses are going through. And when I come out to the public, it just hurts. The fact that people are not taking this as serious as they should be. Due to that, we're going to see an increase in numbers. It's mandatory to wear a mask. But in my own building where I live in, people are not wearing masks. They just get into the elevators with their fellow neighbors, and I don't know what planet they're living in. The least we can do is protect one another.
VOA's Adam Phillips speaking with nurse Rihanna Moret. Strict COVID-19 controls in Australia are separating families of migrant workers who have been stuck overseas since its international borders were closed. Temporary visa holders do not have the same rights to return to Australia as citizens during the pandemic. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Australian Prime Minister is being urged to let migrant workers stranded overseas return to their jobs, homes and families. Hundreds of foreign workers, including those from the US, Britain, South Africa and Brazil, had temporarily left Australia to go on holiday, to study or attend funerals before the COVID-19 pandemic forced the government in Canberra to close the borders. They've been left stranded away from family, partners and jobs in Australia. Chloe Fletcher moved from England to Perth, but is separated from her 16-year-old son, Taylor. He was in Britain studying for exams when Australia's borders were closed and has been refused permission to rejoin his family.
For any mother to be away from the child for that long, the pain's unbearable. It's like every day, it's hard. So I don't understand what the actual boundaries are of what makes a compassionate case, because there's no actual rules or regulations, so you don't know what category you fit into.
Australia closed its borders to foreign nationals on March 20. Authorities say decisions about who's allowed to return under special circumstances are made in the interests of public health. Officials stress that shutting international borders has been one of the key factors in Australia's ability to control the spread of the coronavirus. Australian citizens and permanent visa holders are permitted to return, but face a mandatory 14-day quarantine period in a hotel paid for by the government. Australia has had about 7,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases. The vast majority of patients have recovered, but about 100 people have died from the virus. Lockdown restrictions are gradually being eased across the country. Cafes, restaurants, places of worship and schools are reopening under strict hygiene controls. But those desperate for Australia's international borders to reopen face a long and uncertain wait. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The pandemic has put lives of students on hold, especially high school graduates who have been unable to celebrate the completion of their secondary education with a traditional senior dance, prom, and graduation ceremony. To save the day, award-winning photographer Matt Mendelson volunteered to photograph each one of the 500 seniors of Yorktown High School in Arlington, Virginia. Each portrait encapsulates the graduates' talents, hopes, and aspirations. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with a photographer and some of the graduates.
Just kind of lean on that typewriter top, like that. Yeah, like it's more comfortable. There you go.
Award-winning photographer Matt Mendelson turns his lens on the graduates of Yorktown High School in his neighborhood in Arlington, Virginia.
I just had this idea that I would boost their spirits a little by going around and taking pictures, creating a photo essay of this sort of forgotten class of 2020, and we called it Not Forgotten, the Yorktown Seniors of 2020.
Their school year, like those elsewhere in the country, was cut short due to the pandemic. So were their plans on celebrating graduation. Mendelson says what started as a chronicle of loss for each of these 500 students soon morphed into a tribute to their hopes and dreams.
I ask each senior what they're about, what they love. So each senior is photographed differently based on what they're passionate about, what they love to do.
For Grayson, it's books, poetry, and educating others.
I'm going to be a dual degree for elementary education and early childhood education. So I'll be able to teach from kindergarten all the way to sixth grade. And I'd love to have a book published one day.
Jonathan Saldana wants to be an astronomer.
Actually, it was our unit on lenses and focal points that made me want to build my telescope and why I wanted to put it in my picture, because I feel it's a big part of who I am.
Here we go.
Galilee dreams going into medicine. She was devastated when she heard the school was closing early and graduation ceremony was canceled.
I feel like my memories were kind of robbed for me, so this would be like a good memory that I could like show my kids and would be like forever ingrained in my mind.
Rowan, an aspiring history and philosophy student, finds Mendelssohn's Not Forgotten project more intimate than the traditional high school graduation.
I love the idea behind a shoot, like a personal sense of validation or accomplishment, you know, as opposed to just being another person out of 500.
Yorktown High School seniors are anything but forgotten. Mendelssohn's shoot has gone viral the world over.
I'm getting emails from people from Sydney, Australia, saying, good luck to the seniors of Yorktown High School. We're thinking about you. From Sydney, Australia. It's just a project that was meant to boost the spirits of this senior class, who, like a lot of other senior classes around America, they're all the same. They're all very smart. They're all very passionate. And they all had a chunk of their senior year just evaporate. So it was started out to be a boost, and it's gone crazy.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
A new war of words is intensifying between the United States and China after Beijing hit back Tuesday at threats made by Donald Trump to withhold funding to the World Health Organization. Reuters' Adam Reed has details.
At a press briefing, spokesman for China's foreign ministry, Zhao Lijiang, criticized American rhetoric.
We urge this minority of U.S. politicians to stop shirking responsibilities and shifting blame and strengthen its cooperation with the international community to win the battle.
Trump said in a letter on Monday he would reconsider the United States membership of the WHO if the organization did not commit to improvements within 30 days, and said the body had shown a, quote, alarming lack of independence from China. Zhao added that President Trump had underestimated China by trying to avoid responsibility and distract from how the current situation in the United States is being handled.
Among the U.S. president's specific criticisms, Trump said the WHO made repeated claims about the virus that were grossly inaccurate or misleading, that the agency did not properly pressure China for timely admission of international experts, and that it praised China's internal travel restrictions while being against Trump's decision to ban entry to travelers from China. Trump repeatedly praised China in the early months of the outbreak, writing in late January that the United States greatly appreciates their efforts and transparency. In late March, he tweeted, China has been through much and has developed a strong understanding of the virus. We are working closely together. Much respect. VOA Asia continues. President Trump says he's been taking a malaria drug to protect against the coronavirus, although he has not been shown that he has to fight the virus. AP's Sagar Magani has more.
For weeks, the president pushed hydroxychloroquine as a potential cure for COVID-19 against the advice of top administration medical experts. Now he says he's taking it himself.
Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories.
And says the White House physician signed off. Dr. Sean Conley says in a statement, after numerous discussions with the president, they concluded the potential benefit of using the drug outweighed the relative risks.
You're not going to get sick or die.
But the Food and Drug Administration warned last month that's exactly what might happen, citing sometimes fatal side effects, in saying hydroxychloroquine should not be used to treat COVID-19 outside of hospital or research settings. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Australian states are defying calls to reopen internal borders that were shut to stop the spread of COVID-19. But despite the easing of some lockdown restrictions, Western Australia, South Australia, and Queensland say their borders will remain closed because of the coronavirus, that despite the outbreak being contained nationally. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
Australia is the world's sixth largest country. It has six states and two smaller mainland territories. They've all adopted different approaches to counter the threat of COVID-19. Many internal borders were closed to stop the spread of the highly infectious disease. With authorities declaring the outbreak to be mostly contained, there are calls for borders to be reopened. Australia's federal government and its state counterpart in New South Wales say it would help to revive the economy. There are fears for Australia's multi-billion dollar domestic tourism industry. If people can't travel between different jurisdictions to popular destinations, then businesses will suffer. But Queensland, Western Australia, South Australia and Tasmania have no plans to lift the restrictions. Queensland prides itself on being the nation's warm, sunny vacation getaway, but is still worried about COVID-19 infections. State Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk.
What we know is that there is still community transmission in Victoria and in New South Wales. So as soon as my Chief Health Officer says that I can relax those restrictions, we absolutely will. We want to welcome as many people to the Sunshine State as possible, where it's beautiful one day and perfect the next. But of course, we just can't do that at the moment. We'll review that at the end of each month.
Federal Trade Minister Simon Birmingham said it was imperative that Australians were allowed to move freely across the country when it's safe to do so. There is an expectation that internal border controls will be lifted in the coming months, but international restrictions are likely to stay in place much longer. Australia barred all foreign travellers in March as part of sweeping COVID-19 measures. A major challenge will be to reopen international airports and sea terminals safely, with facilities to screen and monitor arrivals. But the numbers are huge. In 2018, there were 8.5 million international visitors to Australia. Analysts say that any broader reopening of borders might be dependent on an effective treatment or vaccine for the new coronavirus. There have been around 7,000 confirmed cases of the disease in Australia. 100 patients have died. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A new study calculates global carbon emissions declined by 17% at the height of the pandemic shutdown. Tuesday's study found the U.S. had sliced its carbon pollution by one-third during a week in April, and China in February cut its emissions by nearly a quarter. Some global emissions levels were the lowest seen since 2006. AP reporter Seth Borenstein has more.
An international team of scientists found that at the peak of lockdown in April, carbon dioxide pollution levels globally dropped about 17%. But they're heading back up in the end of April and into May. For the year, the scientists figure it will be about 4 to 7% less than last year. That's the biggest drop since World War II. But the same scientists say this is like a drop in the bucket with carbon dioxide pollution, which stays in the atmosphere for decades, if not a century.
The sudden shutdown of a 74-year-old Philippine broadcast network marks the Southeast Asian country's second legal action this year against a media outlet that had challenged the president, deepening worries about media freedom. Manila's National Telecommunications Commission ordered May 5th that ABS-CBN quit operating radio and television stations in the capital. That's what the network said on its news website. It says it was further ordered to take four regional stations off the air. ABS-CBN's franchise agreement had expired May 4th during a long shutdown due to the COVID-19 outbreak, despite efforts by the network to get a congressional nod for renewal. The government of President Rodrigo Duterte disputed terms of the renewal. Duterte felt that the network had swindled him by what he described as not airing ads for his 2016 national election campaign. Herbie Gomez is editor of the Gold Star Daily News website.
I think it's terrible. It's one of the biggest TV networks in the country. The shutdown left a void. There are other networks, but ABS-CBN is different. I think what happened was the reporting of the network really angered the president.
The National Telecommunication Commission denied ABS-CBN due process, said Renato Reyes, secretary general of a Manila-based alliance of leftist political organizations. He especially criticized the timing of the action.
There's a pandemic. You're going to create a lot of jobless people. It's the last thing we need, suppression of press freedom.
ABS-CBN had been playing an absolutely crucial role in informing the Philippines' rural audience about the coronavirus spread, said Daniel Bastard, head of the advocacy group Reporters Without Borders Asia Pacific Desk.
Basically, the way the Duterte administration deals with the media shows that the president's faction just doesn't tolerate independent or critical journalism. And this is a sad reminder of the darkest hours of the Philippines in times of dictatorship.
ABS-CBN was last shut down in 1972 after ex-president Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law and resurfaced only in 1986. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings for this report. Despite a century of advances in design, our aircraft still cannot maneuver as well as birds. To better understand bird flight, mechanical engineers at Stanford University built a robotic pigeon using real feathers, paper, and rubber bands, leading to some surprising discoveries. Matt Dibble has the story.
Pigeons, scorned and overlooked by urban dwellers around the world, but not David Lentink.
I just can't wait to see it fly.
Pigeons are actually amazing flyers. They're really underappreciated. They're very strong flyers. They fly in very complex environments. Our cities are actually really complex.
Lentink is a mechanical engineer who studies birds in order to develop better flying robots. As drones and other new forms of aircraft become common in urban environments, there is much to be learned from pigeons.
Aerial robots and drones, like for example the ones that Google and Amazon are developing for delivery, actually struggle flying in those environments, especially because it's also very turbulent and there's wind everywhere. And it turns out that pigeons have no problem with that.
To understand how pigeons do what they do, Lenting's team at Stanford set out to build one.
Every maneuver and every flight phase, there's a different shape that's best, and that's why birds change their shape all the time.
The team discovered that the complex shapes achieved by birds are possible with simple mechanics.
There's this elastic ligament that automatically redistributes the position of all the feathers as the wing moves in and out.
They also discovered what keeps feathers from spreading too far apart, microscopic hooks that work like Velcro.
It's amazing how it moves.
PigeonBot could radically change aircraft design. But first it might turn up at your doorstep, carrying a package.
If such a robot would be incredibly soft, like a bird, you would not worry as much about interacting with it.
Call it Carrier Pigeon 2.0. Matt Dibble for VOA News, San Francisco.
Two sisters dressed up as clowns are visiting shelters packed with Indian migrants, trying to bring a moment of levity to poor families stranded in cities where they can no longer afford rent or food. Clowns at this Indian shelter brought migrant workers a brief moment of joy. 34-year-old Sheetal Agarwal is a medical clown and a counselor. She teamed up with her sister to try to make people laugh.
So we're going to cheer them up because we feel that if staying at home we can be so unhappy or so sad and stressed, then their level of stress would be very high considering they're not even with their families or they really are worried about the families back home. So we thought it'll be wonderful if we can bring a smile on their faces and distract them from the pain that they are feeling.
Some 650 workers are taking refuge in this sports complex. They've lost their jobs in the city and they're unable to return to their native villages as transport systems have ground to a halt. Sushila Kumari, a migrant worker and mother of a 9-year-old boy, said, despite such circumstance and at such a time, we're feeling a little bit happy. For a brief time, my mind is feeling a little bit free. It's getting diverted, and I'm not thinking about my problems. Otherwise, my only thoughts are about going back home, returning home, and I just feel like crying. This is VOA Asia Weekend. Here's Doug Bernard.
President Donald Trump is doubling down on his decision to take a controversial drug despite scant evidence that the anti-malaria drug is effective at stopping infection or cures patients with the coronavirus. On another front, the president is pushing forward with his threat to permanently withdraw funding from the World Health Organization. White House correspondent Patsy Witakuswara reports.
President Donald Trump, who reportedly has tested negative for the coronavirus, defended his decision to take hydroxychloroquine. He said he has been taking it for the past 2 weeks and dismissed an unnamed survey about the drug.
If you look at the one survey, the only bad survey, they were giving it to people that were in very bad shape. They were very old, almost dead. It was a Trump enemy statement.
There's little known about the drug's effectiveness in battling the coronavirus, but it could have serious side effects, including heart problems. David Sullivan is a professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
I would not recommend people just taking it to try to prevent them getting the virus at the present time, because the risks do outweigh the benefits if you're just trying to take it for prevention, unless you're in a randomized clinical trial where you can find the answer.
In the middle of the drug dust-up, President Trump is also pushing ahead with his threat to permanently cut off funding for the World Health Organization, accusing the WHO of allowing China to cover up its part in the coronavirus outbreak.
Basically, they have to clean up their act. They have to do a better job. They have to be much more fair to other countries, including the United States.
As U.S. criticism mounted, WHO member states agreed to an independent probe into the UN's agency's coronavirus response. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
WHO remains fully committed to transparency, accountability, and continuous improvement.
Trump declined to speak at the assembly where Xi Jinping addressed WHO members. The Chinese president said he supported an investigation, but said it should wait until the pandemic is contained. He also announced China will provide $2 billion to help with the COVID-19 response in developing countries. Robert Daly is the director of the Kissinger Institute on China in the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
China is now working with the rest of the WHO as a member, and it can use that inside the tent status and its professed willingness, I think you can question its sincerity, to be part of the investigation. I think we can expect to see China use that insider status to slow walk and limit the investigation going forward, whereas the United States increasingly is placing itself outside of that process.
The U.S. supported the WHO resolution, but objected the call for universal, timely, and equitable access to vaccines, saying the language used would send the wrong message to innovators concerned about intellectual property. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen was sworn in on Wednesday for her second term. Analysts say she is expected to put down the markers on Taiwanese sovereignty, but not cross China's red lines in her inaugural speech. More now from VOA's Tina Cheng.
Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen was sworn in for her second and final term on Wednesday, making her message loud and clear that Taiwan strongly rejects China's claims of sovereignty over the island. Both sides have a duty to find a way to coexist over the long term and prevent the intensification of antagonism and differences. I also expect the leader of the other side, China, to take up equal responsibility to stabilize the long-term development of cross-strait relations together. In her speech at Taipei's presidential palace, Tsai said Taiwan could not accept becoming part of China under its one-country, two-systems offer, which is supposed to guarantee autonomy. But Tsai called for talks with China so that both sides could coexist. Tsai led Taiwan's Democratic Progressive Party to a landslide victory in January, vowing to stand up to China. Recently, Taiwan has also accused China of keeping it out of the World Health Organization. And during her speech, Tsai said Taiwan would continue seeking active participation in international bodies.
Over the next 4 years, we will continue to fight for our participation in international organizations, strengthen mutually beneficial cooperation with our allies, and bolster ties with the United States, Japan, Europe, and other like-minded countries.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo congratulated Tsai on Tuesday, praising her, quote, courage and vision in leading Taiwan's vibrant democracy. Meanwhile, China's Taiwan Affairs Office said on Wednesday that China would not tolerate any talks about Taiwan's independence.
The novel coronavirus continues to grip many parts of the world, already coping with violence and conflict. Doctors Without Borders has been providing health care in many of these regions, including at a hospital in Kabul, Afghanistan, where one of their midwives died in an attack on a maternity ward that killed mothers and newborns. In this interview with International Edition's Lori London, Doctors Without Borders USA Executive Director Avril Benoit talks about some of the other places of rising concern, particularly in the Middle East and Asia, where coronavirus cases are adding another challenge to these already difficult circumstances.
You all are sort of tracking hotspots and moving as needed, given that this is a moving, evolving situation?
The international and subnational travel restrictions actually make it very difficult for us to move the specialist teams from A to B, but we are managing. It's also sometimes difficult to get the cargo shipments in for the personal protective equipment and other medical supplies that would be necessary. Despite those obstacles, we are managing to maintain a fairly flexible approach to these emergency operations.
Are there any particular places around the world, whether it be a country in Africa or the Middle East, that you are seeing a pattern growing concern that this virus is just beginning to be known how severe it might be?
We look at the models. We look at the reports, which are consolidated by the World Health Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are seeing in Afghanistan is quite a concern to us. As you know, we had recently a horrific attack on the maternity ward in a hospital we've been supporting in Kabul for many years. They came in and specifically sought to kill the mothers and newborn children. The violence is absolutely shocking. In that environment, we also know, because of our work in parts of Afghanistan, that there's very little testing capacity. In those areas close to Iran, which has had a very high burden of COVID-19, we've also been striving to mobilize extra support. So you can imagine the difficulty of thinking, well, are we being targeted here? Are the mothers we're looking after here being targeted, assassinated in cold blood, just as they're delivering babies, at a time when we're also trying to stop a pandemic from wreaking havoc in the country? The complexity of being able to work in an environment like that has us extremely concerned. And we call on everyone who is holding a gun in those kind of regions to please spare the population that is going through enough with this pandemic, to try to certainly spare the health structures. They should be not targets for the kind of violence in wartime that we've seen far too often. We need to be able to do our work to save people and to stop this pandemic.
That was Doctors Without Borders USA Executive Director Avril Benoit speaking with VOA's Lori London. Adjusting to online education in this time of pandemic can be tough. For deaf and hard of hearing students and educators, it's probably even more so. Now, teachers are creating their own online resources in American Sign Language to overcome this difficult time. VOA's Calla Yu has more.
As most schools transition to online education during the pandemic, deaf and hard of hearing students and educators at Gallaudet University are facing some challenges.
ASL is in 3D, where we have our facial expressions and body language that uses space to convey and emphasize concepts. So the online teaching and learning, ASL becomes 2D from time to time. It creates a little bit more of a struggle because students can't really see all of the facial expressions.
Not only that, the lack of online educational materials has also been a challenge for students and educators using American Sign Language. Some teachers had to make videos on their own.
It was frustrating too. The first 2 weeks of being online, I worked day and night on developing all this, over weekends too. So a lot of the faculty members, educators are making their own resources, because what organizations or companies that are providing these apps without captioning and no ASL, we can't access. So no, there isn't anything out there. And that's one of the things that we're struggling with right now.
Deaf and hard of hearing children are also in desperate need for ASL educational materials. Head of Gallaudet University's Digital Education Lab, Melissa Mauskun, is also parent of a deaf child. She finds the English caption on most apps too complicated for her 7-year-old son.
And so my deaf son has to ask me what the apps say. And so then I will read the captioning and sign it to him. So we really have to develop more resources for deaf children that are presented in American Sign Language, fully accessible to the young deaf emergent reader. So that has become more and more apparent to me in this pandemic, that there's a huge gap.
Mauskun and her team developed a new free storybook app, providing bilingual storytelling and arts and crafts activities for younger children. 1,500 families have signed up in the past 2 months. However, on-campus experiences and interactions with teachers and peers are crucial for deaf and hard of hearing students, especially for those whose hearing parents don't know how to sign. They are at risk of being isolated and losing motivations to learn.
Hearing children have immediate access to information, whereas very often deaf children don't, not surrounded and inundated by information and resources. But if we're able to work together to create something for deaf children, then we're able to make up for the lack of resources that they experience.
on Boston University's online platform, Deaf Education Library, educators have shared over 600 videos for early childhood to high school education, all in ASL. However, for students and educators in this unprecedented time, there is still a lot more to be done. Kelly Yu for VOA News, Washington.
After the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended contingency and crisis strategies for frontline healthcare workers in late March, there was an immediate shortage of protective gear in hospitals. A family in Maryland is now doing their part by making face shields at home and donating them not only to healthcare workers they know, but also where it is much needed, hospitals in New York City. VOA's Saqib Ul Islam has their story.
A dot of hot glue on each side.
10th grader Ira and her older sister Amal are making these face shields on 3D printers at home.
My dad's a doctor, and so he has to see like his patients all the time, and even some of his colleagues were infected by the coronavirus, so I wanted to at least do something to contribute.
Inspired by the robotics class and love of their father, the Hussein sisters bought a 3D printer from their pocket money. And once they started printing face shields and donating to individuals, demand and help increased.
That time I posted on Facebook and family and friends, they donated. So we bought two more printers.
According to Ira, one face shield takes almost 4 hours to print. And their three printers are continuously printing face shields according to CDC guidelines. Hussein family says they have donated about 100 of these shields to the hospitals in New York and Maryland. New York's Jamaica Hospital Medical Center is one hospital where these homemade face shields are being used by frontline healthcare workers.
Initiatives like this are very important to us for two reasons. One, because our staff will be well protected when treating patients who have COVID-19. And two, it shows our staff that people in the community, both far and wide, are thinking about them during this pandemic.
Their father is proud to hear this.
We wanted to instill this spirit for them to make an active contribution, be aware of the seriousness of this in terms of how even in small steps they can make a contribution.
And the sisters do understand it.
When the doctors have come to our house to pick up the face shields, they just like express their gratitude and like they say thank you very much. It was like really humbling and we felt really honored because I feel like they're doing much more for us than we're doing for them.
The Hussein family plans to continue printing face shields as long as there is demand. Saqib Ul Islam, VOA News, Fulton, Maryland.
Concerns over the coronavirus have changed the ways people socialize, shop, and work. The pandemic also robbed many students of big events during their graduating year in school, canceling dances, sporting events, and even commencement. VOA's Arash Arabisadi brings us this good news story of one physician's assistant in Vermont who is urging students to donate their graduation gowns to help healthcare workers battling COVID-19.
Nearly 4 million graduates in the United States will this year be denied a rite of passage due to social distancing and concerns over the coronavirus pandemic. It turns out their otherwise wasted graduation gowns could actually save lives.
As an emergency medicine physician assistant treating COVID-19 patients, I have witnessed firsthand the devastating effects both here in our community and beyond. I've heard the horror stories of healthcare workers lacking the personal protective equipment to keep safe.
Health worker Nathaniel Moore recently founded the charity Gowns for Good. He's asking graduates to donate their new or used gowns to more than 75,000 frontline responders registered on the site.
I developed Gowns for Good with the purpose to protect healthcare workers by upcycling graduation gowns. The gowns are more effective than other alternative measures of PPE, given their length, their sleeves, and their easy donning with zippered access.
Moore says gowns worn backwards meet CDC requirements for personal protective equipment, or PPE, by covering critical zones of forearms, chest, stomach, and waistline.
To hear these personal stories of people on the front lines that have nothing, that are begging for gowns, that are begging for any support that we can offer them and as fast as possible,
And we're working just as hard as we can to make sure we can spread our story, get people to donate to help those that are reaching out.
Moore says among the 5,600 donations he so far received, some came with heartfelt notes from parents whose children died years ago before having the chance to graduate. Their regalia seemed too precious to give away, they wrote, until now, when the gowns could save the lives of those trying to save ours. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Please join us next week and be sure you stay up to date by listening to our weekday programs as well as our website at voanews.com and our social media platforms.